$12 in the can.
Total, total county.
Chris, why don't you sitting in for Dave Livermore on his conservation chair, seat?
And Jeff Richards, representing Migratory Bird Protection Service.
Todd Bingham, representing the extractive industries.
And Jeff Demlager with Jacobs.
Holly Baldwin, Pacific Corp.
Bill Polk with HPR.
Marcel Stukas, National Audubon Society.
Tim Hawks with the Brian Shrimp Industry.
Ben Clark with Bob Collins and Associates.
Tom Tripp, U.S. Magnesium.
Ryan Doherty, Cargill.
Heidi Hogan, National Audubon Society, and Bill Winston. Jan Strickland, Legal Union Voters. Ellis Swanson, Bill Winston.
Candace Mastuker, Division of Water Resources.
Anna Bill with the Nature Conservancy.
Craig Miller, Utah Water Resources.
Lynn DeFreitas, Friends of Great Salt Lake.
Nika Roundy, Davis County Economic Development and Great Salt Lake Bird Festival.
Jamie Barnes, Forestry Fire and State Lands.
Steve Erickson, Audubon.
Matthew Anderson, Mineral Resources International and North Shore Limited Partnership.
Ryan Rowland, U.S. Geological Survey.
Joe Havasey, Compass Minerals.
R. Jeffrey Hicks, Utah Airborne Association.
Krishna Patti, Division of Water Resources.
Jeff, let's ask you to come up.
Go ahead, introduce yourself, walking in the room.
I'm Steve Clyde.
Thank you, Steve. Alan. Alan Nelson with the Division of Department of Environmental Quality, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Thank you, all of you, for being here. It goes without saying we have a quorum. Appreciate the advisory council members being here. You received in advance of the meeting a copy of a proposed agenda. I received no changes to that agenda, so I'd entertain a motion to approve the agenda as presented.
So moved.
Thank you, Colin. Is there a second? Thank you, Colin. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? It's unanimous. You also received meeting notes of our last meeting of January 10, 2018. I received no requests for corrections or amendments, so I'll entertain a motion to approve those meeting minutes or meeting notes.
So moved.
Thank you, Dan. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? That's unanimous. So we have a full agenda today. We'll launch into our updates and reports. At our last meeting, we had a report from Jeff Denblaker on the organization of the Great Salt Lake Advisory Committee. Since that meeting, the Salinity Advisory Committee has met and organized itself, and I asked Laura Ault, who I think is chairing that group.
If you...
The Great Salt Lake Salinity Advisory Committee. Would you give us just a brief report on the meeting and where we're at?
Sorry, I just ran up a flight of stairs.
We'll test your stamina here.
So the Salinity Advisory Group met, 6 weeks ago, perhaps, for their first meeting. We're working on putting together the sort of enabling language of the group and the bylaws and all that good stuff, and I think it was a good first meeting. I think everybody was in attendance except one person. And then Lynn invited the Salinity Advisory Group to do the Wednesday session of the Great Salt Lake Issues Forum. And so different members, Jake and I all started off talking about why there's a Salinity Advisory Group and how the breach came to be in the Great Salt Lake. And then different members of the advisory group will be giving presentations on their area of knowledge. Is that kind of
correct?
Am I right, Lynn? And then we'll finish up, I guess, with what the goals of the Salinity Advisory Group are kind of going forward and wrap up. So there'll be a whole Salinity Day session of the Salinity Advisory Group on Wednesday, May 9th, if anybody would like to attend. And that'll be our next meeting.
Right. Any questions of Laura about that group? Off to an auspicious start. Congratulations.
Okay.
No questions. We'll move on to the next item on the agenda. By statute, the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council is to receive technical support from the Great Salt Lake technical team. The technical team is going through some reorganization right now, and in looking at our responsibilities with the technical team and our role with them, we felt it might be useful, since I don't think very many, if any, of the advisory council members actually attend the tech team meetings, that we ask Laura Burnham, who staffs the tech team, to give us just a brief report on presentations at the tech team. So it'll give you a flavor of what they're dealing with, a little bit of information about the issues. And then if you're interested in any follow-up, you can go to the tech team's website, and they have these presentations posted, and you can go through the presentation yourself. Or maybe it'll even stir you to be interested in attending the tech team meeting. And if you're okay with it, I'd like to virtually every one of our meetings just add a few minute report on some of the research and technical presentations that are made there. It'll give us the Cliff Note version or the Reader's Digest version, and ask Laura to give us basically what the scientific question is and what the conclusion of the research might be. So, Laura, fire away.
Sure. Well, as I was looking into doing these reports, diving into some of these scientists' reports and presentations and trying to distill it down, it was really challenging, and I hope I do them justice and don't upset them. But I thought today we would just focus on Phragmites and some of the research that's been done recently. Karin Kettering presented to the tech team on October 17th. She presented on October 17th about Phragmites control, and her questions were how best to control Phragmites, and then how, which we've been looking at for years, right? But then how to best restore native plants in the face of drought and other challenges. So she looked at a fall herbicide spraying for Phragmites, or what they found in their control group was that a fall herbicide spraying for Phragmites was better than summer. So now we've all kind of adjusted our schedules when we're treating frag to spray in the fall. Glyphosate is similarly effective to imazapyr, but is more cost effective than imazapyr. So we've shifted our what chemical we use, what herbicide. And then mowing or intense grazing in the summer before initial application prevents the seed production. So that was kind of her highlights on how best to control Phragmites, and then how the native plant recovery is proving pretty challenging. The dense Phragmites stands obviously impede native plant return. The Phragmites decomposes faster when wet, however, so keep it wet to get some of the native plants to come back in, and then mow in the summer to accelerate decomposition. Native plant recovery is minimal except when plots were established near the native stands. So in areas that aren't completely inundated with frag. And bulrush, which is a quite desirable species, native plant species, is bulrush recovery is especially limited after treating frag. So tips for Phragmites control, according to Karin Kettering's crew, was that Phragmites must be healthy and not drought stress for the herbicide to be effective. So that's been interesting and helpful for us these past couple of years when water hasn't been too plentiful. Water management improves outcomes. You keep the units wet before and during herbicide application. After treatment, drought stress helps frag regrow. So you want to pray for rain after you treat Phragmites, and then deep water prevents Phragmites return, but also native vegetation. So that was Karin's group, and looking at how to treat Phragmites, but I also wanted to go back to a report that Water Quality did some time ago. We ended up taking this information to the legislature last year, I think helped us get some our funding for Phragmites treatment. But they looked at the estimated consumptive water use of Phragmites in the Great Salt Lake Basin. So Omar Omangarda, is that how you say his last name? He quantified the water requirements for Phragmites in the Great Salt Lake Basin as well as native vegetation. So looking at the comparison between frag and other native plants. He conducted a literature review on evaporation and plant transpiration. Gathered data about the aerial extent of Phragmites in the basin, and then developed a conceptual model to estimate the consumptive water use from frag. And what he found, monthly Phragmites evaporation evapotranspiration range from 0.69 to 9.96 millimeters per day, or 0.81 inches per month, to 11.76 inches per month between March and October, with an average of 4.1 millimeters or 5.2 inches in a month. The greatest water consumption of frag obviously occurred in the hottest summer months, July and August. The areas that he looked at occupied with Phragmites in the Great Salt Lake Basin were 21,276 acres in Great Salt Lake wetlands and 2,125 acres around Utah Lake. That was according to a study done in 2010. And so I found 23,052 acres of wetlands around the Great Salt Lake. This is Lexi Long's estimate in 2014. So I think the take home from this research from DWQ, and this is the information that we presented to the legislature, was that the consumptive use of water by Phragmites was calculated as for the whole Great Salt Lake Basin was 82,181 acre feet of water in the Great Salt Lake wetlands and around Utah Lake. That's using the 2010 data, and then 81,498 acre feet within the wetlands of the Great Salt Lake. So if you think of that much water being used up by Phragmites each year, that's why we are looking to Karin's team to figure out how to remove it and then how to restore native plants. So those are my two reports for this month.
Thank you. Any questions? It was excellent brief summaries like that that got me through English Lit in college.
Cliff notes.
Just a question, and maybe you've had the conversation before. I have the wonderful privilege of being on our local mosquito abatement district, and their field reps talked with me the other day about all the money they spend on aerial spraying to deal with mosquitoes and Phragmites, and like you could there, and it's frankly not as effective as they'd love it to be.
To treat mosquitoes and frag?
Yeah, and so they're interested in having some conversations about, could there be, especially in certain areas, is there potential for partnerships of maybe dealing with it and, you know, solving their problem and this larger problem? And I just wondered if you've ever had that conversation with
them. I have not had a discussion about mosquitoes and frag before, but it's something we can look into.
Okay.
Come across anything, we'll get back in touch. Jeffrey?
I just want a real quick clarification. Could you tell me again when you said it was 82,000 acre feet on one thing and then another 82,000 on another? Does that mean there's like 160 something thousand acre feet?
Well, it's using the two different sources.
Okay, so it's the same thing.
One just looked at the Great Salt Lake, so the wetlands. Lexi Long's research just looked at Great Salt Lake wetlands, where the other research looked at Great Salt Lake and Utah Lake wetlands. So the acreage is a little larger, that's why the first number is a little bigger,
okay.
Acre feet.
And then it's water use or transpiration or both?
I think the consumptive use of water, so yeah, both.
Just curious, what's the comparison to open water consumption, because there's an evaporation, so it's not 80,000 net, if it was open water, it'd have a loss also.
Sure.
I'd be
and
curious to know
saline
what that
water. I don't know what that rate is. Does anyone in the room know?
Yeah, the evaporation rate along the Great Salt Lake areas is about 45 to 55 inches, depending on who's measuring. So that's just fresh water evaporation.
So how does that compare to Phragmites?
Well, if you've got a million acres, you've got 4 million acre feet of evaporation. You got more.
Well, if you have 40 inches of water, just if you have open water, how many inches do you lose to Phragmites? Because if you're saying it's 80,000 acre feet of savings, that's not the case if you have to, if you're now trying to.
Normal evaporation on Great Salt Lake is around 3 million acres.
Okay.
3 million acres.
I guess the comment, the question would be, is that data rolls in, we need to compare it to a baseline of not zero water use, it's what it would be after the removal.
When it's replaced. Yeah. I think that's some of his next steps that he was interested in doing.
Okay. I just want one more clarification that Phragmites being gone would not be open water, it would be native vegetation, so it's hard to figure that part out.
We'd hope.
So if Phragmites was gone, it wouldn't be open water.
Well, you'd hope they'd have mudflats too.
Yeah, but even that, a lot of that is planned.
Yeah.
And Salicornia, and there's vegetation, so it's not just straight open water. I just want to make sure that was clear.
Okay, great. Thank you, Laura. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. There are a lot of really great presentations at the technical team, and hopefully we can plug into some of those without having to take the whole meeting.
Leland had a question.
Leland.
Well, the question is the goal to eliminate Phragmites and replace it with native plants? I mean, or is the goal to just eliminate Phragmites? From the mosquito abatement, we've had discussions a number of years ago with mosquito abatement folks over what to do, and what they really wanted everybody to do is find a way to channelize all the flows out so that they could have a pathway to spray rather than to have to spray across broad areas. But obviously that then eliminates a lot of the wetland areas too. So is there an established goal as to how and what can be done for Phragmites?
I don't think the division's goal is to eradicate it. I think we've come to think that that's nearly impossible, but I think to control it, to manage it, to handle it, knowing that some of frag would still exist along with native plants.
Yeah,
implies mudflats.
A reseeding and a revegetation plan in our Great Salt Lake Phragmites plan for certain areas, but again, certain areas should just be open mudflats too. And so we look at that in our Phragmites plan.
So thank you, Laura. We can come back to it if there are any action items we want to talk about later, but let's move on the agenda. The next item on the agenda, are people amenable to having these brief technical reports at our meetings? Fill our responsibility with the technical team? All right, we'll continue to do that. The next item on the agenda are Great Salt Lake issues in Utah State Legislature. Laura Alt's going to... Commissioner, we have a chair for you right here. Laura Hall's going to start. We're going to tag team this a little bit. We're going to talk about some forestry, farm, state lands issues. I'm going to talk about HB 374, and Leland's going to give us a little report about legislative action or inaction on membership of our group. So.
All right. So I thought first, I don't know if you want to talk about, it sounds like you're going to talk about some bills, but I can talk about a couple bills that we had.
I'm only going to talk about
one. Okay.
274.
All right. So we had... SB 69, which cleaned up some language in our sovereign lands statute, mostly clarifying state lands and sovereign lands being the same thing. So Senator Dayton ran that, and that was successful. It's just a cleanup bill. And then probably the other big two are HB 216, which allows, it gives the division $500,000 one time and $500,000 ongoing to do improvements to the Jordan River, including law enforcement. So we hope that with some of the things that might clean up the water in the Jordan River, do some things will have a direct impact on the Great Salt Lake. And then there's HB 272, Utah Lake Amendments, that deals with the division's ability to dispose of land in turn for conservation projects done by private folks on Utah Lake. So those are the biggest bills that we were watching, and then Don will talk about the other one. As in terms of money appropriated out of the restricted account, this is what we've come up with so far. It's still kind of sorting out all the details and going through all the bills. We were successful in getting $500,000 one time for Great Salt Lake Phragmites removal, which we've had the past couple years. It dipped to $300,000 at one point, we're back up to $500,000. For those of you that have been following the Weber River case, we now own a mile stretch of the Weber, but the same evidence was used in almost a 40-mile stretch, so we got $100,000 thanks to Representative Hawks to deal with how we implement sovereign lands procedures on the Weber River. We got a Utah Lake analyst position as well to deal with some of the issues that are arising on Utah Lake. $200,000 for improvements at Bear Lake, $500,000 for catastrophic wildfire reduction. And Great Salt Lake Research, this one was kind of a surprise to us, but there's a one-time appropriation of $100,000 and an ongoing appropriation of $50,000. We're not really sure.
Is that the tech team?
Yeah, Santa Claus brought this. We're not sure who. I mean, there was some talk, but it ended up there. So
that's not the horror.
We'll take it, I guess. So, like we said, we're still sorting through all this. There was a marsh money given through us to the Utility Commission for a marsh master to do Phragmites work. This was another surprise to us. DEQ got a supplemental of $126,200, which that comes out of the account immediately for algal bloom. And then some one-time algal bloom money of $178,500, and then a Utah Lake Commission pass-through of $500,000 that we're still sorting out. And then the Jordan River money I talked about is comes out of the general fund. And then Don can talk about this branch of royalty amendments funding. Any questions, Laura?
So is my understanding that the 100 one time and the 50 ongoing is to fund salinity research, right? It's for the Great
Salt Lake. It just says Great Salt Lake research.
That's not part of the tech team grant.
And that's not part of the tech team grant. I mean, I think the idea is the tech team grant was reduced $50,000 a few years ago. So we're straying to sort of, I mean, ideally we would probably like to use it for salinity research, but.
So I think Steve, are you the follower of that? You begat that money?
Well, I don't know where that money came from.
Okay.
I've got plausible deniability.
So it was, I mean, there was some talk that went through and we said we'd take it if it was given to us, and here it is. So.
Great.
Yep.
Any questions of Laura?
And nothing's over until July. Like, it's all still till July 1st when it all goes into effect. You know, it's still moving pieces and parts.
Okay. All right, let me talk a little bit about the Brian Shrimp Royalty Amendments. In the October interim committee meeting of the Committee on Natural Resources, the committee did what they call a deep dive, where they assigned different members of the committee's different government programs to research them, understand them, and then present to their peers what they found. Representative Stuart Barlow was assigned several programs, including the Endangered Species Mitigation Fund. And as a result of his research, he reported to the committee that the Endangered Species Mitigation Fund had a large surplus, and that he felt that perhaps there should be a suspension of the funding source or a reduction in the funding source. As you may know, the sole funding source for that fund is the brine shrimp royalties that we've been paying since 1997. And so his thought was, we'll either suspend that or we'll cut it back to get rid of that surplus. I wasn't at the meeting, didn't know what he was doing or saying, but I got a few phone calls that day. We ended up meeting with Representative Barlow, and also met with Director Mike Styler, who had some concerns about the issue. The original approach was just to cut our royalty. After meeting with Director Styler, he and I agreed it would take a dual approach. It would get a instead of a full cent reduction in the royalty, would take a half cent reduction in our royalty. And the other half cent, which is about $125,000, would direct to the Great Salt Lake. And the way that would work is that the $125,000 on an annual basis of revenue from the brine shrimp royalty would go directly to the Sovereign Lands Restricted Fund to be spent as directed by the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council. So we've kind of moved away from the argument we can make that we have no money. Effective the next fiscal year, and on an ongoing basis, the Advisory Council has $125,000 to work with Forestry, Fire, and State Lands to spend. Representative Barlow and Senator Hinkins, who was the Senate sponsor of that legislation, deserves the credit for that action. Any questions about that?
Good work.
Thank you.
Don't spend it all in one place. There are a few clarifications that we're seeking. The money may not be available until February, and someone much younger and much smarter than me has raised some issues about maybe some wording changes, some technical changes that would make it flow a little better for the department. So I told Laura I'd work with her in that regard, and I appreciate her wisdom in that area. But the bottom line is the money was appropriated on an ongoing basis. Jeff.
I'm trying to make it quick, but Laura hit it really just for a second. I want to see if we can get some clarification on what the ramifications are. SB 272, now these Yahoos have shown that they're willing to sell the land under Utah, the sovereign land under Utah Lake. Is there any way that we can protect the Great Salt Lake sovereign land? I mean, if they'll sell Utah Lake, won't they sell the Great Salt Lake? I mean, the developer waived money and they said sure.
We have the state's preeminent water lawyer here. I imagine there's a legislative fix to do that, but the legislature can always change their mind, right? So just be vigilant in preserving and protecting the lake, I guess.
Okay. I mean, does the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council have any say in that?
We've never discussed the issue. I mean, it's a relatively new issue, right?
Yeah.
It kind of came out of the blue. None of the people around this table ever had the ingenious idea of building islands in the lake, right?
They've had the ingenious idea of selling sovereign lands.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, let's put that on the to be discussed if there's an interest. Any other discussion or questions about legislature?
Just a quick clarification. I got some more info from Erica yesterday about the DEQ funding that's up here. So the two algal bloom funding pieces, those were funding that DEQ requested out of the general fund, but for whatever reason, they wound up getting appropriated out of restricted account. And then the Utah Lake funding is something that we didn't request in our budget. So, yeah.
We did that. But we didn't request it out of here again. We requested it from general fund. And they made the last minute decision to switch it to here. And that was to help with the research on Utah Lake for determining water quality analysis, because there isn't enough money.
The original requests for the Great Salt Lake research were also out of the general fund, not the restricted account.
Laura.
I will say there is a little bit of a concern on the balance of the restricted account. It takes about $8 million a year to operate the division. And current inputs have been less than around $10 million. So when you add the one time and the ongoing, it causes us a bit of concern about that.
I would say that the $125,000 that we direct is funded out of the brine shrimp. Well, yep. we give up half of our reduction to fund that. So.
Yeah, that one doesn't concern me.
That one nets out.
Yeah, that one nets out. That's not some of the other large requests give us a little heartburn, to be quite frank.
Understand.
So when we make a general fund request to fund our division, hopefully, works.
Okay, great. Any other questions about the legislature? Let me ask Leland, who chairs our membership subcommittee and keeps us fully, most of the time fully, I was going to say staffed, but keeps our 11 membership spots filled. Give a brief report on status.
There are 5 positions that need to be filled or refilled. June, those would be the position of Don Leonard for the aquaculture, myself and publicly owned, Jeffrey Scott for Box Elder, Dan Tuttle for Tooele, and Tom Ward. So those individuals need to go on to the boards and commissions website, and that's at boards.utah.gov, and refill out the application. For Jeffrey and for Tom, all you need to do is go update your application because you haven't been on it as long, so it's not a big deal. For Don, for myself, and for Dan, we need a letter from the commission saying that you are their appointed person. Because you've been on for 2 terms, in order to get them to go for a 3rd term, we have to have that. And we need them done anytime in the next few weeks, like 2. Boards.utah.gov. Fill out the application. You may have to sign in or get a sign-in capability. But that's how you're going to reapply. And that'll be the case for everyone else in 2020. You'll need to make sure you fill that out. And the same thing applies for... you might want to take back the day. There'll have to be an exception to the existing rule for Dave to get reappointed. Because at that point, he will have 10 years. So we'll need a support letter from the environmental community, so to speak.
Any questions, Leland? Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate your vigilance on that. Let's move to the next item on the agenda. Legal strategies in the council report, water for Great Salt Lake. As you recall, last year we initiated an effort for the purpose of helping to inform the debate about elevation or water level of the Great Salt Lake. And what we decided to do was to prepare a report containing potential strategies to address water elevation or lake level for Great Salt Lake. We wanted to have an open process and welcome any ideas from left, right, middle, whatever. And we went through that process and in September accepted a report with 72 possible strategies to address water levels in the Great Salt Lake. In our November meeting, we reviewed those 72 strategies and pared them down to 18 preferred strategies by council members. So we had a series of ballots to determine which were the 18 preferred. And then in a January meeting, we went beyond that and actually ranked those 18 preferred. And I have some copies of those. We sent out a list of those. Let's send this around. I have some copies. I don't know if I have enough copies. This shows the ranking of those 18. And then at our January meeting, we decided we wanted to educate ourselves about both strategies that we prioritized and some others that perhaps we hadn't, with the eye to determining whether we wanted to move forward in the future and actually advocate for the adoption of some of these strategies. Now again, these strategies were presented by the general public. No real serious editing or changing of them. So if there are factual errors, they're not ours, they're the errors of the author. If they're brilliant ideas, the author deserves the credit for the brilliant ideas. So you take the good with the bad. We determined that, interestingly, when we did the ranking, if you look at the ranking, numbers 20, from 23 to 43 in our report all had some kind of a legal connection. And we sent out an excerpt to council members of those legal strategies. I'm going to read them really quickly. Implement a state-mandated conservation pool using the public trust doctrine, denying water rights applications to protect the public interest, expand state agency acquisition of water with appropriated funds or acquisition by gift, donation, lease, or other arrangement, expand the ability to purchase or otherwise acquire water for in-stream flow uses to any of these other than state agencies, pass legislation to set minimum stream flow or lake level, authorize pooled leases, authorize water banks, authorize split season leases, allocate reservoir storage for the benefit of the Great Salt Lake, allow contractual arrangements to limit water withdrawals, allow statutory reservation of unappropriated waters, end statutory prohibition of condemnation, employ migratory bird protection, change beneficial use designation to Farmington Bay, make Great Salt Lake one regulatory unit, use the anti-degradation statute to protect Great Salt Lake tributaries, allow irrigators or other users to send unneeded water downstream without being penalized or risk losing their rights, develop and implement other measures to supply water to Great Salt Lake, lease early, late year senior water rights, change zoning laws to encourage higher density in development, and implement a dry year contract. I had one water lawyer tell me that was a lifetime of litigation. Interestingly, among our preferred or prioritization, if you look at that list, from 25 to 40 are all legal, have legal implications. And interestingly, 39 was our number one rank, 30 was number two, 40 was number three. So they not only were preferred, but they were highly ranked and therefore of some significance. We've invited Steve Clyde, preeminent water lawyer in the state of Utah. I could read his biography, but just suffice it to say he's been the water lawyer of the year for every organization that cares about water for the last 130 years.
Not been around.
Yeah. Anyway, we're honored to have Steve come and ask him if he would take a look at what we're doing here and provide some commentary or comments on these legal issues, particularly the ranked ones. So, Steve, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Don. Thanks. There are lots of old friends and familiar faces around here, so it kind of feels like home. This is great. I had a really good teacher in my father, Ed Clyde, and learned an awful lot of water law at his side for about the 20 years I had the privilege of practicing with him before he died. And I was so much enamored with the profession and water law in general, and having spent a lot of my young life on a farm and turning water in ditches, I just couldn't think of anything I would rather do than be a water lawyer. I have partners that do divorce work and other things, and I look at that and say, my God, if I had to do that, I would quit years ago. But this is fun. And working with legislature and the policy people of the state has been a lot of fun and very enlightening. I don't view this as a discouraging tale. There is more dialogue happening in the state today about how we can do conservation, how we can make do with less, because I think we're all beginning to recognize that a winter like this may well be our new normal. And if it is, how do we deal with the incredible competing demands for this declining resource, a doubling population, and very much increased awareness as to the environmental needs for water? That kind of prompted me to write the paper I did for the October 2017 CLE that probably some of you have seen. It's clearly not the best piece of scholarly work, but what I tried to do there was consolidate into at least one place a lot of strategies that have been employed in a lot of other states that appear to be working. And most of those have been incorporated in your strategies here, and many of the good ones, in fact, have been prioritized, which I think bodes well for the future. Any of these strategies is going to run into some very difficult obstacles. First and foremost is the political philosophy of our legislative body and our policy leaders that are fierce property rights advocates and look at anything that might intrude on the vested property right of a water right to be something they simply are not willing to tolerate. We saw one knee-jerk response come from the legislature in response to the stream access litigation. And Representative McKiff brought forward a bill that basically attempted to exclude water, period, from the application of the public trust doctrine. That passed the legislature. It's being challenged in court. My assumption is it will finally lose in court. And perhaps we'll get back to the bill Representative Falke put together that I thought struck a really good balance and compromise between stream access for recreational use of the water while protecting landowner interests. We need more of that kind of policy dialogue, and we're just not seeing a lot of that yet at the legislature. I'm hopeful things will improve. So we've got a political philosophy that is somewhat against intruding on property rights. We have the appropriation doctrine itself that is simply not conducive to conservation. Right now, under the law as it exists, if I am an irrigator and I have a canal that loses 20 or 30% of the water I divert before I can get it to my field for application, that water goes back into the system. I can put that, excuse me, I'm fighting the cold. I can put that water in a pipeline, or I can cement one of my ditches, and I can save that water. And if I save that water, I have no legal right today to use it. I basically, if it is going back through seepage and getting back into the natural water course from which it was diverted, either surface or groundwater, that constitutes return flow. And anyone downstream who has relied on that return flow has a vested property right in that quantity of water, and they have the entitlement under their rights to receive it in quantity, quality, and timing as they've historically done. That is a very, very strong deterrent to investing in conservation. We have seen in other states, Montana would be a good example, and Oregon and Washington, where they have allowed those who are willing to invest in conservation benefit from that savings. and take the water they have been able to conserve, use some of it for their own economic return, provide some of it to the state either through leases or otherwise for in-stream flows, and create an environmental pool of water, if you will, that can go there, but give enough of an economic return back to the ag community that they have an incentive to invest in more on-farm efficiencies. Utah needs to go that direction, and a lot of the proposals in here take a fairly constructive approach to that, not necessarily dealing with the saved water issue and taking that away from people, but looking at how we might go to on-farm irrigation and recognizing that if we can get more efficient application and reduce the consumptive needs on the farm, or at least the diversionary needs on the farm to get water to the field, we might then use the water they actually need more efficiently in application, and then take the water that is left over and find a way to channel that back into environmental flows. The other aspect of the appropriation doctrine that is really a negative is that we are first in time, first in right. If I quit irrigating to harvest my crops and I leave my water undiverted running in the stream for 2 weeks, the next person downstream in priority who has a right to divert can take all the available water to the satisfaction of their water right. And the inability to legally move the water from point A to point B is very, very problematic in terms of in-stream flows. We can create in-stream flows, we can do a lot of expanded authority in that regard, but if you can't get it past the next diverter downstream, you've accomplished very little. And so we've got to address that from a legislative perspective and figure out a way how to put this water in a category where it is protected and can be shepherded from point A to point B and get where it needs to go. Some of the tools that have been suggested here, I think, are aligned with that philosophy. I like the water banking approach very much, for example. If water can be diverted in priority so that you can be assured there is water physically there in the water right, and move that into storage, into a bank, either in surface storage or even groundwater storage, where it can then be actually banked and recovered, we could treat that water differently. It no longer would be water belonging to the stream. It has been reduced to the possession of the parties who put it in storage, basically. It's in a bucket at that point. And I can move that bucket of water wherever I want to and prevent intervening diverters because it isn't theirs. I've already taken possession and control of the water by diverting that and putting that into a storage facility in lieu of putting it on my land. And we do that to some extent already with irrigation reservoirs. Most irrigation reservoirs were constructed by junior appropriators. They did that in recognition that their water rights were going to run out in terms of their direct flow rights, and if they were going to be able to economically farm and have a valid water supply late enough in the season to do something, they needed to store water in the spring when the flows are in excess of anybody's beneficial needs. And that's why all our major irrigation storage reservoirs were constructed. Now, once that water is released from storage, the state engineer today will help administer that water down and make certain that it actually gets to the parties who own the water right. So if I have an irrigation company and I have shareholders miles downstream from the reservoir, even though there may be many intervening diverters who in priority can take the native waters that they're entitled to divert, they do not have a right to take my stored water because that's mine. And I can divert that and deliver it down to the parties entitled to receive it, whether it's a shareholder in an irrigation company or a lessee who wants to move water all the way to Great Salt Lake. So I think we have those legal tools to do that. Of course, the most efficient of all of these proposals is the public trust doctrine, and it's also the one that will be the most political lightning rod in the state. And if we attempted to do that, clearly every diversionary water right on every tributary inflow to Great Salt Lake could be reduced to make water available to get to the lake. You would practically have to do that in order to sustain a minimum level in the lake on a routine and controlled basis. and there would have to be enough water moved to overcome the net evaporative loss, which is about 3 million acre feet a year. That's a tremendous amount of water. The chances of doing that without drying up all the other uses is pretty impossible, but legally it's possible, just practically and politically impossible in this state. And so what are the better options? We've got these two extremes. We've got public trust, we've got priority, where I can demand the entirety of my water rights, stand on my priority, and insist I get all of my water. Or we can find some middle ground. And most of these other strategies go to that middle ground. Looking at split season leases, for example, is a really great example of how that has worked in other states. And if it's combined with water banking, where water can then be put in a bank and stored for later use and later delivery down the system, that works really well. The way that would work would be to start administering irrigation rights more on the context of depletion rather than diversionary rights. Right now, we quantify a water right by saying I need 4 acre feet per acre to effectively irrigate 1 acre of alfalfa. To do that, we're taking into account the water I need under flood irrigation regimes, where I've got to have water at a sufficient flow head to carry it across my field and get the water where it needs to go. But if I look at that under depletion factor and say I can maximize my economic return as a farmer by taking maybe my first and second cutting of hay when we have better rainfall, we have cooler temperatures, get better growth. And in the late summer, when the stream flows are down and it's more difficult to get water available from the stream for my property, if I could say I'm willing to defer my third or fourth cutting of hay, if I can get an economic return equal to that so that I'm not losing money. How can I do that? Well, I can say my depletion right, let's say it's 50% of the water I'm diverting. So if I've got 400 acre feet of water as a diversionary right, I'm entitled to consume 200 acre feet. The other 200 make it back into the system one way or the other. But if I say I'm willing within my 200 acre feet to harvest one and two crops and leave 100 acre feet of my consumptive use available, why can I not, as a farmer, lease that consumptive use to some other utilization, whether it can be for an in-stream flow or to go to another city that has drought relief issues or other ag users? But I can do that, and if I am being paid as a lessee, or a lessor rather, for making that available depletion accessible to others through a water bank or otherwise, then I can get an economic return equal to what I could have done farming. I can park my tractor, go on vacation, not buy fertilizer, not buy diesel fuel. And I'm pretty content as a farmer to do that because I farm for economic reasons. Some people farm for fun. Most people farm for economic reasons. Having grown up on a hay farm, it lost its novelty rather early in life. But it creates an opportunity, at least, where that can be done. If that's combined then with a water banking program where the water then could be moved into storage, that really works very well. Part of the problem with that is that our major storage reservoirs are Bureau Reclamation Project reservoirs. The water in those reservoirs is already fully allocated to the parties who purchase that water from the project sponsors, whether it's the Weber Basin District or the Central Utah Project, Provo River Project, or even the Strawberry Valley Project, which is one of the oldest reclamation projects in the nation. All of that water is currently allocated to somebody. But within all of those reservoirs, there is flood control space. And in Jordanelle, that I'm most familiar with, in Strawberry, but Jordanelle is a really good example, there are 12 tiers of space available water that are non-project water that are being stored in Jordanelle for a variety of uses. Some were environmental. We've taken all the water rights that were used for irrigation in the Heber Valley, have moved all of those into storage in Jordanelle, built sprinkler systems, delivery systems throughout the valley, and when then deliver out of Jordanelle on call the water they need to meet their on-farm demand through sprinkler systems, the historic return flows are then released to mimic nature out of the reservoir to keep water at minimum flows in the Provo River all the way to Deer Creek Reservoir. And then minimum flows are also implemented all the way down from the Deer Creek Dam to the mouth of the river for June sucker reasons. That shows how it can be done if you were willing to put an investment into that kind of conservation. Without intruding on property rights, the farmers still get the benefit of every drop of water they had, and they can change that water, convert it to domestic use for development, dedicate their shares. But we've been able to do that, maintain historic return flows to protect downstream interests, while also doing things that enhance the environment by re-sinuizing the river, got rid of the old flood control dikes between the two reservoirs, restored the wetlands in the north fields. All that was done under Bureau of Rec project purposes, has not intruded one bit on anybody's water rights or property interests. In fact, it's enhanced them, because moving the water through the filtration of the wetlands has helped the whole water quality in the Ebor Valley. Those kinds of things are things we can do, and there is excess storage capacity in almost every Bureau of Reclamation project reservoir. To use those, we've got a contract with the federal government, probably have to go through an EPA review and a variety of things, and then that water would be put into the reservoir again on a space available basis. So in a year like last year, where the reservoir's filled, all that water is spilled. We don't have any ability to hold it. On a year like this, if someone said, geez, it's not worth trying to farm this year, but if I can put my water in a bank and store it in one of these major upstream reservoirs, get a revenue return from that water that would equal again my own farm income, that can be done. It can be released on storage on call to go to the lessee, whether at that point it's an environmental flow all the way to the lake or other uses. But that's feasible today under current law without really treading on anybody's interests. It just takes money. And money is the other serious problem we have, because conservation takes money. If you look at the Sevier River drainage, the Sevier River is literally dry dammed about five different times from its headwaters all the way to Delta. And what makes the water back is return flows after the water has been applied to the land. It accretes back into the stream, picked up again, stored, and that process repeats itself up and down the river. Going to sprinkler application cuts down that return flow. And when that happens, it starts impacting the water rights of every water user on down the chain. You could say, well, that's fine. You have an obligation as a water user to be efficient in your use of water. And if the volume of water you need to physically irrigate your land is still there, you simply don't have the carrier water now to take it across your field because of upstream conservation. Your obligation is to become efficient as well. On the Sevier, however, that doesn't work so well, because once you get down the system, everybody is on sprinklers. They are already operating about as efficiently as humanly possible, because they're on the tail end of the system. And so more conservation upstream has more and more impact on downstream users, and that does start intruding on their property rights. One way we might do that is to invest state money into that conservation effort and say, fine, we realize that this will have an impact on you, so we're willing to invest state money in helping you become more efficient in your use, utilize the available water, and move some of this water on down the system. Do we have a vehicle to do that? I think we have the public welfare aspect of our existing appropriation law that would help in that regard. People ignore the fact, they think they have this vested property right and a water right that is the equivalent of fee simple absolute title like they have to their land. But that isn't the case. Water is owned by the state. And a water right is a conditional property interest. It is a right to use a specific quantity of water from a specific source, diverted at a particular point of diversion for use on a particular place of use. And I'm limited by the sideboards of that water right. I can't enlarge my depletion, can't enlarge my diversion, and I can't decrease historic return flows because that impacts somebody else. But But if you look through 7338, which is the controlling criteria for the approval of any water right application, some of those criteria are the state engineer can reject an application if it's deemed detrimental to the public welfare, if it would impact some more reasonable beneficial use of the water, or it would harm the natural stream environment. Those three criteria give the state engineer a tremendous amount of power under existing law. It's simply never been exercised up to this point. They sometimes get paid lip service. I have seen limited application of that up in the Snyderville Basin, for example, when the historic irrigation right that was relatively junior in the system. They wanted to retire from the land, put it into condos. State engineer was willing to approve that application, but said, geez, under normal irrigation administration of these water rights, you're cut off on priority late in July. If we're going to allow you to make an entire season use of that water full year, we need to reduce the volume of water you're going to divert. Otherwise, you're going to be enlarging the water right by diverting year-round and taking more water than historically you've actually had available to you because of your junior priority. And then they did another thing. They said, we also believe, because taking this water out of the system for condos, drilling it from wells, is going to reduce the flows in East King and Creek, which is already an impaired stream under a TMDL and problems in East Canyon Reservoir. They also forced the appropriator, as a condition to approval of that change application, to leave even a little bit more water behind in the system. And so that water right was reduced fairly considerably in order to allow development, both in terms to protect the environment and to protect the historic return flows of the system. That one slipped by without anybody challenging it. I was really surprised, but it did. State engineer did not really discuss public welfare as part of his analysis on that, but that really was coming into play. And that those three criteria apply both to new applications to appropriate, and they apply to change applications as a result of the Bonham case. Back in the 1980s, it said the change applications have to be evaluated under the very same criteria as applications to appropriate. Given that reality, every water right that is appropriated is subject to public welfare. And you could then, in the context of a change application, take a water right and say, I'm now going to change to some new use and take my full depletive right and use it for something else. I think the state engineer has sufficient legal authority today under the public welfare aspect of the change application laws to say, fine, but we will reduce the quantity of water we're going to allow you to transfer into this new use and maintain some minimum flows as a condition to your making a higher and better economic use of that water, if you will. That's not a bad trade-off. That's legally there and it exists, but it kind of intrudes on people's sense of what their property rights are. It would not be a politically popular thing to do, and I think the legislature, well, at least I know the state engineer is going to be reluctant to step out very far on that without legislative policy guidance. We tried a couple of years ago through the Executive Water Task Force that I serve on to push a bill forward that would put definition behind the public welfare so that as the state engineer makes a public welfare analysis, there are set criteria that they can look at, because right now the statute's absolutely silent. And so nobody knows what is in or not in the public welfare. It would be first up to the state engineer to make that decision, and thereafter up to the courts to tailor it back if they think the state engineer has exceeded his authority. So we thought it might be better if we could put into the statute some set criteria looking at whether or not it's displacing better economic uses, whether it is causing environmental harm. The Senator Dayton, much to my surprise, as one of our more conservative senators, agreed to run the bill. She thought it was a great idea. Didn't get out of committee that year, and we haven't gone back. Nobody's been quite brave enough to propose it again. But I think the time has come with the dialogue that is currently happening about getting water to the lake, something we ought to do, because if we could get those criteria there, it would give the state engineer legal cover to make those kinds of determinations. And would give the court a measure to look at and say, well, the state engineer, these were the criteria, the state engineer has acted within those criteria in making this decision, I think we would find them sustained. Right now, about the only application we've seen to the public welfare component is when Deer Creek Reservoir was constructed. State engineer, or the governor actually, under the statutory authority he has, withdrew all of the remaining unappropriated water of the Provo River from appropriation so that they could finish the planning of the Provo River project. When that was ready to go, Bureau of Reclamation got its appropriations ready to file. State engineer lifted the governor lifted the withdrawal order, reopening that water to appropriation. But before the Bureau could file its application, a former state engineer who was aware this was going on filed an application to appropriate all that water for hydropower generation. And the proposed location for that hydro facility would have precluded the construction of Deer Creek Reservoir and the availability of water for all the multi-purposes that were there. The state engineer, using public welfare power, essentially leapfrog priorities and put the Bureau filings ahead of the hydropower filing and said this one, that is a multi-purpose project that will provide irrigation, municipal flood control, recreation, and those much broader public uses is more in the public welfare than a private hydropower project that will generate one individual some money, and simply circumvented it. And that was sustained by the Utah Supreme Court. It was challenged. But that's the first legal application we've seen go to court on public welfare. We've seen a couple of state engineer decisions that have done that down in Beaver County. Again, they've kind of paid lip service to the notion that we would force Central Iron County Conservancy District attempted to basically appropriate all of the available groundwater in Beaver County for its future use. It was going to build a pipeline, come up and drill wells, and pipe all that water back into the Cedar City area for long-term future use in lieu of the Lake Powell pipeline participation. Beaver County really bucked and said, well, wait a minute, that is our future economic growth. We are one of the few areas in the state where our agricultural economy is growing. And yes, we can dry up our ag lands and change that water to industrial or some other use. But we have viable mining options, we have solar, we have geothermal, all of those are happening right now. We need water, it is the groundwater that will do that, otherwise we dry up our farms. And farming down in that community is a big deal. And economic studies were done in opposing those applications of Central Iron County, said the loss of the ag sector is not a one-to-one loss offset by industrial development, because there are so many, if you will, trickle-down economics, I hate to use the term, but if you have a vibrant farming economy, you have farm labor, you have implement salesmen, you have sprinkler equipment salesmen, all those industries are driven by the availability of water for those farms. You take the water away and all those industries shrink along with it. Industrial use, mining use, and those things require water. They create a few jobs, but they certainly don't put the kind of broad population to use that the ag economy does, and Beaver County really wanted to maintain that. State engineer, notwithstanding that, and I've represented Beaver in those arguments, and we really pushed hard on the public welfare aspect of it. The state engineer came in and said, well, within these discrete groundwater basins, we think there's X acre feet of developable groundwater before we exceed safe yield. We're going to force you to hold back that much for Beaver County, but we'll approve the rest because, again, priority drives everything in Utah right now. And so, again, there's been some minor steps forward, but we're going to take more policy direction. The legislature has got to be the one to help do it. The appropriation doctrine is common law, is shaped by the courts, but it takes decades for public policy to work its way through the courts on a case-by-case basis that is dealing with one little discrete issue that happens to be before the court at a time. The legislature is where broad policy decisions can best be made, and we really need to go back and say, look, let's put definition behind public welfare. Let's give the state engineer the tools we need to help deal with some of these issues, recognizing that we have these environmental issues that are deserving of some reasonable equal footing in the law with beneficial and depletive diversionary uses. I think that can happen. But lastly, I really like the notion of watershed councils. It's a takeoff, if you will, from what they're doing in Australia, where a stakeholder bottom-up driven water allocation. Each year, they look at their available water supply, they use the best available science, and say, this is the quantity of water we have available, these are the competing demands, and who's willing to give up some of their ag water to deal with these issues so that everyone can have some. And that's worked pretty well in the Murray-Darling Basin up until last year, and all of a sudden greed started taking over again, and public interest or self-interest started taking over again, and people started cheating and diverting water they had agreed not to take. They have one advantage in their water law is that nobody has a vested property right. It is a permit that is granted year to year and is subject to annual adjustment depending on the available water supply. We can't quite go there because we already have vested property interests established in our water rights, and so we can't back off that very easily. But what we can do is implement some of these other things through watershed councils, look at the competing demands, and then go to the farmers who have the water and say, look, we've got all these needs. Are you willing to forego or fallow some of your land to make water available for these environmental flows? And I think money will talk, and I think if we work within the marketplace that honors priorities, honors the property rights, and uses the marketplace to drive transactions, we can probably make this work without taking the real draconian step of a public trust doctrine lawsuit, which would just, like I say, would be an absolute lightning rod in Utah right now. We can't do that. And I've drone on a lot longer than I intended, but if you have some questions, I could try and answer them quickly, and then I suspect I've overdone my time.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Jeff and Todd?
Yep. Steve, appreciate all of that and all your work in this area. You know, as you talked about some of these creative ideas, the one, I think, area of skepticism that has been raised, and I think in particular with the Bear River, is that water flows to money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you create some of these opportunities for additional use of water, the net result is the Great Salt Lake ends up getting shorted because there's water going in, it's being wasted because it's water that's going into the Great Salt Lake now.
Yep.
Do you believe that there could be a structure and not perhaps relying just on the welfare provisions of the state engineer's office discretion there now? But is there a structure that would actually create some kind of mitigation provision of what you're talking about that would end up in a net wet water into the Great Salt Lake?
Yeah, I think so. And again, it really is a combination of these things from a water bank, maybe using Bear Lake that has a great big storage component to it. If Pacific Corp would be willing to make that reservoir available for that kind of use. And then we could go to the farmers, and as you say, money drives where water goes. Go to the farmers and say, if you are willing to scale back your depleted use of this water, we will pay you for the privilege of putting that water in storage in Bear Lake, and then we can deliver it out of that water bank bucket to the lake to help get some net gain in the lake. The farmer has not been impacted economically. They can make rational decisions based on how much water they've agreed to use this year. That works pretty well. We've seen with the Bear Lake settlement that occurred up there among the recreational interests, the irrigators and Pacific Corp, that we're operating Bear Lake very much that way right now. They sit down through basically a watershed council, look at the available water supply. Once we have a pretty good gauge of the snowpack in April, we know what we're gonna have. And they then make rational decisions on how much water we want to hold in storage, take care of the recreational interests, while also making sure the farmers have the water they need to deal with their limited use. And farmers voluntarily have scaled back. It's given them, I think the assurance of knowing how much water they would have in a given year, they can then make rational decisions on how much to plant, how much they can plan on harvesting this year, don't overextend themselves only to find they don't have any water. And once that water is in the bucket in Bear Lake again, serves as a wonderful storage facility. That water could be taken from the bucket and run to the lake. And I would even think the industries on the lake might be willing to help fund some of that, to put that water in the bank for use to get it to the lake. Now, again, you got to fight the battle that once it's in the lake, the extractive industries have the water right to divert and take the water back out. And so if it's getting to the lake only to be diverted again, have you accomplished much? So it's got to take the stakeholder-driven approach where everybody who is involved, from the environmental, from the industrial group, to the farmers, to the recreationalists and others, to sit at the table and say, these are the priorities we have as a society. What are we willing to do to get there? And if we work that way, I think it can work. But taking any one of those in isolation, I just think finds too many obstacles.
Can I ask one follow-up? So, and even if there was a mitigation component of the depletion and a consumptive portion that would end up kind of being in, you know, M&I use, doesn't that also return back to the Great Salt Lake?
Yes, it does.
So it isn't sort of double use, right?
Clearly does. And even on our M&I use, they're only about 20% consumptive. The rest is coming back in the form of treated effluent to the extent you have a discharge plant. One of the real issues we're facing, though, is that with the doubling of population and a potentially declining water supply, is that that effluent is becoming more and more a target for reuse. And to the extent it's reused, it will not get to the lake. And yet, money will drive that where it can go into secondary irrigation and other things for communities. Even from irrigation in a sprinkler system in a city, there is going to be some return flow. There will be some water get back, but certainly nowhere near the volume of water currently being discharged by our mechanical plants up and down the Jordan River and against the lake. So again, you could look at some of those things as stakeholders and say, geez, we recognize this community, if you could get some of that effluent back into a secondary irrigation system, it would let you better use your available good water in storage for your culinary use and use some of that and make a better utilization of that existing water. But how about guaranteeing that some of that water continues to get to the lake? And by doing that, we continue to help put some water there rather than simply dry things up. It's a tough sale. And again, you've got to overcome net evaporative loss on top of that, which becomes realistically, you could drop every drop of water from Jordan Hill, Deer Creek, and half the Weaver River rivers into the lake and not make a dent. There just isn't that much volume of water stored upstream. And with an exploding population, that water is badly needed for human consumption. And so this is going to be an ongoing tension. And I think we've got to continue to work with that, work with our cities on landscape ordinances and other things to try and get to conservation within our cities. The domestic use, you can't save much. You can put so many bricks in the toilet, it isn't going to do a lot. So it's landscape irrigation where savings can occur. And as we've seen in Las Vegas, notwithstanding all the complaints people lodge against them, they have actually seen a doubling of the population in Las Vegas without increasing their water needs at all. They've done that through conservation. That can be done. It's taken money again. They've bought people out of their turf grass. All those things are possible if the state, as a matter of policy, is going to say conservation and environmental mitigation is equally important as consumptive use, and we will put money behind it as a state to help make that happen.
Todd, you're in line, and then Chris?
Maybe just at the risk of time, I know we've got a lot of things we want to cover, but I've got a list of
questions. I know someday we'll go talk.
And just for those of you who sat in the room here, I think you've just gotten CLE credits for a level 400 water class. So, congratulations. So Steve's forgotten more about water than I've ever known. So, but there's a lot of questions and things. I love the idea of a water bank. I love the idea of trying to get water to the lake. I think just to echo a few of your comments, you're right, prior appropriation doctrine is king here, and that's that in and of itself poses one of the biggest challenges. As the ag industry has, you know, maybe I'm in a unique position having represented the ag industry, and them looking at whose water am I conserving? As they start to conserve water, and the Sevier River is a great example of the bottom of the stream has gone to all sprinkler, but if the top of the basin and the river all goes to sprinkler,
bottom's done.
What happens to everything? It completely collapses in on itself. So a lot of good questions. I think you'd have to do a basin by basin implementation. The thoughts from an ag perspective too, it carries a dairy farmer. If you have 10 dairy farmers in a room, you have 12 opinions. Mm-hmm. That's just how it works. You have to do it on a farmer by farmer basis. The thoughts of taking that second or that third and fourth crop out, I like that idea. If you're an ag producer who sells their alfalfa, you're probably much more inclined to do that than an ag producer who produces their own alfalfa for their own feed. So case by case is going to have to be done each way there.
And that's what I like about it, is it can be voluntary.
Individuals
can do what meets their needs best.
Yep. And then maybe just lastly, some of the basins, as we know, are already over-appropriated from a paper standpoint. So, you know, those folks that are saying, yeah, I'd love to put my water back into the river as an in-stream flow, again, prior appropriation doctrine, folks that are downstream saying, okay, well, I've got a junior right, but you know, you're conserving your water. I don't want you conserving my water.
Correct.
And that's gonna be the real difficult part. But we've been talking conservation for many years with not a lot of real substantive wins. And I think, you're right, getting everybody at the table to really start talking about how we do a entire water system conservation effort is critical, and it's probably going to take some lengthy, serious discussions on what do we do with first in time, first in right, what is beneficial use, how does it impact others, where does the money come from, how do we get the legislature to appropriate all those things. So, you know, I'm intrigued by what you talked about.
Well, those are all the real tough policy issues.
Yeah.
Reminded of something my dad told me very early in my career. He said, one man's waste is another man's water right.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what Todd's saying, that if I conserve upstream and sell that water I've saved, I'm taking it away from somebody else, and I'm forcing an impact up and down the system. And so the water banking proposal, watershed council proposal, is very much a basin-by-basin oriented approach, because they're clearly one size won't fit all. Every river system is different, even within a drainage area. You've got isolated areas like Chalk Creek on the Weber that is a very discrete system that could be dealt with in a very easy way, whereas opposed dealing with the breadth of the Weber system may be much more difficult. So it's going to take a lot of that kind of thinking.
In the interest of time, let me cut it here, and for the next couple of minutes, just restrict it to specific questions from council members of Steve. Chris?
Both water in stream and water getting to the lake, most of the strategies generated, both priorities and the bigger list, depend on real water getting to the lake. And so just how much of it, and if the whole system was metered, then I think you would have some basis to show downstream people that their water was not getting taken. How much of an obstacle is the fact that we can't, the system still needs more work to function well? Are these strategies, can we still run some experiments, or is it such a fatal flaw that you can't monitor and meter it carefully?
It's clearly an issue. I don't think it's a fatal flaw, in the sense that we already monitor diversions for irrigators. Almost every system is under the control of the state engineers, river commissioners, that monitor diversions and shut people off in priority. So we have a pretty good handle in terms of diversions. We don't have a handle on the on-farm usage necessarily, but even that could be metered, particularly when people go to sprinkler systems and we have a little more definition as to what they're applying. You look at the Jordan River drainage, it's over-appropriated on paper 4 or 5 times. And so you've got an awful lot of paper rights out there that have absolutely nothing behind them, except in maybe the most random of water years, like 2003 or something, when we had more water than we knew what to do with. The adjudications that are ongoing in the state, however, will help solve that problem, because a lot of these old rights that simply have nothing behind them will be cleaned out of the system. And that's the real advantage of a general adjudication. I really applaud the legislature for putting some funding behind that. The adjudication on the Provo River occurred in the 1920s. It started again in the 1940s. And I doubt it would, if we were moving at the pace they had been moving, it wouldn't be finished in anybody's lifetime in this room. It just couldn't. But they've now got this compressed. We've got funding, we've got staff, and things are moving rapidly. State engineer is moving through the Salt Lake Valley like Sherman through Georgia right now. He's just marching. And things are coming together. So that's a positive sign. Metering is a positive sign. Surely metering on secondary irrigation within communities makes all kinds of sense to help people realize what their use is and conserve. Secondary irrigation works really well in a new community where you can afford the infrastructure costs. To go in and retrofit Salt Lake City would be astronomically expensive and simply not feasible. City can barely deal with the upgrade and repair and replacement of its existing system. But with the new areas, the west side of the Salt Lake Valley that are growing, new communities in Davis and Weber counties, that ought to be mandated. The county and the cities ought to force that, because that again allows them to hold their better quality water available for domestic use, put irrigation quality available for secondary irrigation. And as these ag lands come out of irrigation and move into some other utilization, there is always going to be water in excess of the needs of the domestic use that can go into a secondary system and be used. We've got to make better, smarter use of the available water. And the risk I see is that we're going to have a declining water supply, and that even makes this a more difficult decision. But it can be done, my belief is, through the context of the appropriation doctrine without intruding on the property rights, and make it work through marketplace-driven transactions. We've seen on the Colorado Conservation Pilot Program that money works, and farmers have fallowed large-scale tracts of land to put water available, try to get it down to Lake Powell and Lake Mead. That's been an experimental program. It's had some tentative funding, but it's worked. I think that shows how money can help drive this discussion without impacting the property interests, and let market-based transfers drive this. The environment often loses, however, in a market-based transfer because they cannot compete in the marketplace. And that's where I think the legislature, once again, has got to step in and say, we think this is a priority from a policy standpoint for the state, enough that we will put some money behind that to help make it possible. Absent that, it is going to move to money, and that's cities and developers and large ag users, and it won't accomplish the end goal, and let's get it back in the stream.
Thank you, Steve. Last question, if it's quick, Donald.
Well, and I'll ask for a simple answer. I know Steve, and can catch up with him later. One of the pieces of tentative legislation that's been discussed, and I think will be discussed this next year, is expanding those that can hold in-stream rights.
Correct.
from the current, you know, limited uses. I'm going to give you an example here, and the question is, so the example is one of the oldest rights next to the Great Salt Lake is the Duck Clubs.
Right.
And their beneficial use is to allow the to hunt ducks, right? The Brine Shrimp Collective does not have a water right on the Great Salt Lake yet. But just if you go with me here, if a duck club can hold a water right to have, you know, water pass all the way up from the upper watershed down to the lake, to significant amounts, I think last time, at least one of them is like 30,000 acres. It's a huge water right. Would that in-stream legislation allow room for, we've got extractive industries on the lake, we have the harvesting industries on the lake, certainly we've got the duck hunting on the lake, and while we meet those commercial needs, it provides significant but ancillary benefit all the way through the system. So the short answer to the question is the legislation that's been discussed at the task force, would it allow for that type of use, or maybe that's something we can talk about this next year?
It needs further discussion. Clearly, you can say we're going to do that and make water available for in-stream flows. but then you run into the institutional barrier of priority appropriation that says the next guy downstream in priority can still divert it. How do you get it to the lake and make sure it goes to the use that it's intended? And that's where we need some legislative changes so that we can protect that water that is for that purpose from depletion, either from the extractive industries or ag use or domestic use upstream. Okay. It's feasible, but it's got to take some changes in the existing law.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve.
If I can just add one thing, you know.
30 seconds.
The water right is not actually for hunting that the duck clubs own. It's actually for vegetation.
Mm-hmm. I was taking a pretty good leap there, but I know this is part of the dialogue that'll go into the next session, and maybe there's a way of, as we think bigger on that, to take care of everyone in the pond.
Creating a water right for duck hunting.
And then you got to offset that against the damage to the wetlands and removing the water. I mean, there are trade-offs on everything you do when you're dealing with water.
Steve, I can't thank you enough for sharing.
My pleasure. Appreciate the invitation.
Thank you so much. I sense there are a whole bunch of questions we don't have time to ask. Do you mind if we send some your way and see if you're willing to answer
them? Let me leave some cards on the table here, and you can call me. Happy to sit down and talk with anybody on this.
Thank you so much. Okay, next item on the agenda, public comment. I'm gonna ask by a show of hands if there's anyone here who wants to make a public comment.
I do. I just want to thank the advisory council for taking the initiative to work on this kind of study and for inviting Steve Clyde here today to help educate the council in this discussion, because obviously there's a lot of work to be done. So thank you very much.
Good job. Thank you, Lynn. Anyone else? Bless you.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go back and make a living.
Close the public comment period and move to the agenda item, council deliberation actions. Are there any items on which the council would like to take action today? I would ask the question about if you'd like to continue the practice at our next meeting, have a couple of brief research reports, and then tackle some topics out of our report. I noted that the number one prioritization was around legal topics. Clearly, number two is around conservation. Would you be interested in having some presentation or discussion about conservation next time, perhaps Tate Flint or Darren Hess from the Water Conservancy District or Warren Peterson from
I would recommend if you do that, you might want to get, say, Warren from the ag side for Farmland Reserve and Tage from the Water Conservancy. That would get a couple of different perspectives, because you know, this is really, really complicated. And I love the direction we're going, but this is going to take, you know, just as a note, there were two bills this session that Steve already talked about.
Yeah.
One is the taking of effluent that comes out of POTWs and appropriating it. And the legislature's looking at that and saying it's water that's just going to waste. Well, as Steve said, someone's waste is someone's water. So, you know, we were concerned about that as an industry because that water comes down here into the lake. The second one was extra jurisdictional water issues and also on secondary water metering. And there was a very detailed discussion on secondary water metering. Now, it sounds like a great idea, but the cost to an individual who's in, say, Weber Basin would be $1,200 to that individual to meter. Now, we need to get there, but how do you do all that? So it's, I think we need to start the dialogue as a council, because the end goal is what we all want, which is how to get water to the end of the road.
Can I maybe amend that? I think it's good to have them here, but I'll go off of Jeff's comment. They're conserving it so they can send it to their users in their service area. They're not conserving it to send it to the downstream. So it means zero to us, unless part of that dialogue is how does that benefit the system downstream.
And furthermore, with the waste of water, there is a return component of that ends up getting to the lake. If
the wastewater is owned by the prior, whoever, if it's a culinary water right, that's 100% consumptive water right. So that's the issue he's mentioning. Until the statute changes.
I understand that, but it's still going to the lake. It's consumptive. That's why they don't want to change that right, is that it's a consumptive right, but it's still flowing down. So
that dialogue, you know, as you bring them here, there's a lot of issues that Todd and Jeff are bringing us that ought to be part of that conversation.
Leland, you know,
along the Wasatch Front, all that wastewater, almost all of it, gets to the lake today.
Mm-hmm. If you appropriate it.
And then the issue is there a way of taking those consumptive rights that exist today and finding a way to move them into the lake rather than to have them go into a reuse process. That would drive conservation so that the conservation would pay for growth, not just taking the reuse out and putting it into water systems so it pays for the growth. So, you know, one of the things we could do would be to look at how to ensure that reclaimed water actually is dedicated to getting to the lake, because it's a significant chunk of water right now.
That was on the list, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was on the list of the
Don, can I add something to that? So representing municipalities, right now, all, as Leland says, all those water rights that go to a city, that's 100% consumptive. So they could, they don't have to do a new water right, they don't just need to change the statute, they just need to conserve the water and take it into their system. One item that we've been discussing, or at least I have with Eric Gaddis in water quality, every municipality, well, this, we have water quality regulations as well. And one of the ways to meet water quality regulations is to remove pollutants that might get into the stream. But if the stream goes from 1,000 second feet to 100 second feet to 10 second feet, and you have the same amount of pollutant coming from a city, suddenly now you're going to have to treat that pollutant from your cities under your municipal stormwater permits. On the Eastern Seaboard, they've ended up spending, in some cases, more money treating this municipal stormwater than they did at the wastewater treatment plants, because you have a dwindling source. There's a concept that EPA has approached, but it's only been applied under consent decree, where you have conjunctive use, where under a municipal stormwater permit, you're allowed to say, look, instead of cleaning up whatever this might be, because I know the stream's getting smaller, 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 I'll just be chasing it forever, let me provide water. So now you have a water right statute that's already under the priority case. Every city that has a high priority can use all that water, but if you give them the ability working with water quality, and I think there's some legislative, at least, understanding that might need to become, or even legislation that might need to occur, a municipality, instead of spending money treating that water, they can provide more water in the stream. That's what conjunctive, that's one conjunctive management. An example I'll give you is up on the Willamette River up in Oregon, they had to spend, I think it was close to $100 million on a wastewater treatment plant to put chillers in, because the temperature was going up because of their wastewater. Instead of spending that money, they spent it on planting trees under a conjunctive management agreement with the state. They ended up with the cool water, a much better habitat. It actually was a conjunctive project with the farms, so you have best practice. What I'm saying is that we're binding ourselves by our historical legal framework, and there's some tools that we can apply in the future, but it requires municipalities, the ag community, the legislators, and the administrative rulemaking folks to work together. So there's some tools out there that, if we're creative, we might be able to find water and keep it in the lake.
Thank you, Tom. We're a little bit past our adjourn time, and I want to be sensitive to people at other conflicts. Dan, last shot, and I'm going to close this
okay.
down.
First part. We need to have a lawyer from the industry, the extracting industry also, just to make it a little more fair. And secondly, I gave everybody on the council a National Geographic. Read it. There's an article in there about drying lakes. We're in there. So it isn't just Phragmites I'm interested in.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks,
thank you, everyone, for being here. Obviously, we have a lot to talk about. Fortunately, we have some more meetings this year. I think the trick is going to be to convert words to action, and action that can actually have results. And that's an objective and maybe difficult to accomplish, but I appreciate everyone approaching this with an open mind and trying to see where we go. Thanks to all the presenters today. Our next meeting is May 16th. If you ever have any suggestions in between meetings about something we need to talk about, please let me know so we can try to get it on our agenda. And thank you again for being here. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So made.
Thank you. Is there a second? Thank you, Gary. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye. Any opposed nay? Any extensions? It was unanimous.